Bob McChesney coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today our guest is going to be one of the prominent journalists of the last few decades in the United States, a columnist, Alexander Coburn, columnist for The Nation magazine, LA Times, formerly The Wall Street Journal, and the co-editor of Counterpunch, the newsletter and the vastly popular website that you can go to at counterpunch.org. Alexander Coburn will be joining us for the full hour today to talk about journalism, media, and politics. So sit back, relax, and call in if you want. But first, before we go to Alex Coburn, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Millions of people listen to internet radio every day. One of the most successful webcasters, Pandora, has about a million listeners daily and is one of the 10 most popular applications for Apple's iPhone. Yet Pandora and many other webcasters are close to shutting down their operations because they can't keep up with the royalties they must pay to performers and record companies. Last year, the Copyright Royalty Board, a federal panel of three permanent judges, ordered that webcasters more than double their payments per song. For Pandora, a site that lets customers create their own stations and listen for free, royalty fees will amount to 70% of its projected revenue. Webcasters have strongly objected to the hike, saying the CRB unfairly singled out internet radio for the increase. Webcasters must pay two sets of copyright owners, the owners of the musical works, usually the songwriter or composer, and the owners of the sound recordings themselves, a record label or the recording artist. Traditional radio stations pay a flat per-song fee and are only responsible for royalties on the musical work. The Internet Radio Equality Act, proposed in Congress to nullify the hikes and modify the fees, gathered more than 100 co-sponsors, but has stagnated in committee. Since the CRB ruling, deals have been cut between Sound Exchange, the organization that represents artists and record companies, and satellite and cable radio. The negotiations have cut their royalty rates to less than half of what webcasters pay, but independent webcasters like Pandora haven't been let in on the deal. Last week, Representative Howard Berman from California entered the fray. He's trying to mediate a deal between the webcasters and Sound Exchange, but the two sides remain far apart. For more information, go to savenetradio.org.
This month, the courts have ruled on some important issues involving copyright. A New York court refused to stop the distribution of the film Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. EMI Records and Capitol Records had alleged that the filmmakers violated copyrights of John Lennon's Imagine when they used a 15-second clip of the song while showing images about religion and science. The court decision established for the first time that fair use applies to copyrights in sound recordings. Sherwin C., staff attorney for Public Knowledge, explains the term fair use.
There's certain uses that aren't infringements. If a use of a work meets certain criteria, it's not an infringement of copyright. You want to be able to quote things. You want to be able to critique things. You want to be able to use copyrighted materials in education or in news reporting. These things shouldn't be considered copyright infringements because they're important parts of public discourse. So these would be fair uses.
In another case, a federal appeals court ruled that Cablevision's remote DVRs, which work like off-site TiVos to record television programs, didn't infringe copyright. The court ruled that there was no significant legal difference between the remote DVR and a VCR or a TiVo.
Basically, it's functionally identical to a TiVo. Just the way in which it's built is different.
The Supreme Court has previously ruled on Betamax and VCR technology and affirmed that it's okay to have a device that records programs off the air.
The fact that anytime the technology changes, you get more lawsuits, that's a problem. These lawsuits will keep new services from coming out, keep consumers from being able to use them.
It's much more important than simple convenience or having a new gizmo to play with, says C. Being able to use material allows us to participate in cultural and political conversations.
The ability to record things and to take in that media and to remix it, to play with it, to excerpt it, If I find somebody saying something that I think is horribly wrong or offensive or bizarre on TV, and I want to show how offensive or strange or wrong that is on my blog, I can record that, transfer it to my computer, I can post it on my blog, and then start talking about it. If I just want to critique something or comment on it, I can do that. Being able to do that and show literally what it is that I'm talking about is a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool politically. It's a powerful tool culturally. We shouldn't lock people out of being able to do that just because technology has evolved and just because it's changed.
For more information, go to publicknowledge.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, this final Sunday in August 2008 on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, coming to us live from California, is prominent journalist and columnist Alexander Coburn, the editor of Counterpunch, the tremendous website that gets a lot of traffic, as well as the newsletter Counterpunch, also a columnist for The Nation magazine, and now I see the LA Times. Alexander Coburn, welcome to Media Matters.
Good to hear from you.
Great to hear from you too, Alex. And there's a lot of ground to cover in politics, which is your beat, certainly. And I noticed today you've got an article up on the lead on the Counterpunch website with your assessment of the Democratic Convention and Obama. So I thought I'd start by asking you to share some of your thoughts about Obama, the Obama phenomenon, and how the convention went for the Democrats last week.
I'm not a huge fan of Obama's, but I thought they did what they had to do there. I thought his speech wasn't too bad, well delivered, sort of decorous pugnacity, I think was the phrase I used when he went after McCain a bit. And, of course, Michelle, everyone likes Michelle, me included. I thought she gave a good speech on Monday. The basic thing about Obama is, I mean, this. I still have a lot of problems, of course, with his politics and what he's saying. I mean, starting with the fact he says America's profoundly divided. I don't think America's divided at all, really. I think America's rather united. They think Bush is a complete idiot. They don't like the war in Iraq. They think the country's been hijacked by neocons and billionaires. And so where's the... I mean, of course, there's a fraction of neocons, billionaires, and people who differ. But, you know, I think there's more of a coherent majority opinion than there's been at any time since Nixon got kicked out. And so my argument would be always at that... I remember in the middle 70s after Nixon resigned, and there was a pretty radical mood in the country, and, you know, let's change all this stuff. And exactly at that moment, all the papers and the Washington Post started saying, you know, now we must have bipartisan consensus, meaning let all the bad guys get off the hook and just go on as before. And something about that, about Obama, it's always struck me, you know, that we can, everything can be brokered. Well, there are a whole bunch of things in the world that can't be brokered. And the only way you're going to get change in America is by taking on all the usual suspects in a vigorous political campaign. And, of course, Obamaism hasn't produced a movement. There's no real movement behind Obama. There's a lot of a certain emotion, but there's no real constituency to push, help him push things through. That's the basic problem, I think.
One of the points, Alex Coburn, in your piece that you made was that conspicuously absent this year from prime time during the Democratic Convention was former President Jimmy Carter, who 4 years ago gave what was regarded as one of the premier primetime speeches at the Democratic Convention. What accounts for the Carter absence?
Well, obviously, if you're a former president who then says Israel is an apartheid state, you're not going to be very popular at the Democratic Convention, which he wasn't. And I read a couple of stories. I mean, there seems to be a slightly mixed theory. Some people say that actually he was never really scheduled to give a speech. And he himself, of course, denies that he was axed. Then other people say, well, he was axed, and they really were just desperate not to have anything, if possible, anything at all, but they had something of Carter. But, of course, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, they're absolutely mad keen not to do anything to offend the Israel lobby.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Alexander Coburn, speaking to us live. You're in California, Alex?
I am right here in Northern California.
Out in Northern California. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you want to call in with questions or comments for Alex Coburn, the phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Alex Coburn, you've written a lot about the Middle East, and we had you on our program 2 years ago to do a full hour on it. And, a lot of our listeners are young. They're just getting their feet wet in the news. And what would you say to someone whose basic view of the world, or certainly the Middle East, has come from conventional U.S. news media to the extent they've gotten any coverage of the world or the Middle East? What's the missing in the story of Israel and Palestine and the Middle East in the U.S. news media, in your view?
Well, for anyone who's just been relying on the mainstream media, it'd be like someone still relying on maps of the world before they said it was round. I mean, you just have to read history and get some exterior sources of information or alternative publications, starting with Counterpunch, of course, and all your fine work, no doubt. But what they would not know, of course, is the real situation of the Palestinians. I mean, they wouldn't even know that, in the world today, there are a few more inhuman things going on than the starvation and the siege of Gaza. Just a level of absolutely horrifying suffering being deliberately inflicted by Israel on the people of Gaza, Palestinians, with the United States and the European community denying these miserably poor people any assistance, humane assistance at all. They wouldn't have a picture of really what Hamas is all about. That Hamas, in fact, like actually Arafat for much of his career, has made abundant indications. This is the elected body representing the Palestinians, democratically elected. And they've said, of course, that the conditions for recognition and mutual recognition are there, but Israel has to make some kind of a move, which it's refusing to do. So they would have no picture of who does represent the Palestinians. They would have no picture, really, of the appalling, aside from Gaza, just the regular humiliations, deprivations, thefts, cutting down of their trees, inability to conduct their life as farmers, the gradual encroachment of settlements on their lands, the bisection of the West Bank by a huge amount of Israeli-only, Jews-only roads, the theft of their water, endless attempts to extinguish all hopes of statehood for Palestine. They would have no idea of that at all.
Why do you think the press coverage is so bad of Israel, Palestine, and the United States?
Because there's, of course, huge historical sympathy for Israel, huge, and has to be said, a lot of the American media are owned by American Jews, starting with the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, people say it's an anti-Semitic thing to say. It's not. It's an actual fact. If the press of the United States was owned as exclusively or as generally by Irish people as it is, in fact, by American Jews, people were pointed out all the time. They talk about the Irish-controlled press or the Italian-controlled press, but people obviously are careful because of the heritage of Nazism and anti-Semitism in what they say, but it's led to the fact that, a lot of stories, the New York Times and the Washington Post's coverage is absolutely disgusting.
Our guest, Alex Coburn, here at Media Matters. The numbers again, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Alex Coburn is a columnist for The Nation, and now the LA Times. Is that right, Alex?
No, not really. I don't know where you got that from. I mean, maybe some ancient piece of paper.
It must have been, because it was news to me, too, when I read it this morning.
I wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal in the 80s.
I remember that.
I contributed a lot to the LA Times op-ed page in the 90s. When it was bought by the Chicago Tribune, I was promptly axed. And then now I actually have a column that's syndicated through a creator's syndicate.
I see. And that's carried by a number of papers. And, of course, there's always the Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org, and one can subscribe to the print newsletter.
Sure can. You can go to the website. We change our stories every day. We have 5 or 6 or 10 stories a day, as you know, and then you can buy our books and get our newsletter.
One of the big news stories this summer, Alexander Coburn, has been what's taking place with Russia and the Republic of Georgia. Mm-hmm. John McCain now declares we are all Georgians. Cindy McCain and Joe Biden have both been dispatched to the region. Both Joe Biden and Barack Obama, in their speeches at the Democratic Convention, made reference to the Russian invasion, being quite critical of the Russians and supportive of the Georgians. What's your take on what's going on there, and what's your assessment of what's missing in the sort of U.S. story about the what's happening there?
Well, it starts with what's missing. I mean, it's, as is generally conceded, if you read anything other than a headline or the initial, very often in these affairs, it's the first days, as you know as well as anybody, probably better, it's the first day's headlines in the mainstream press that set a tone. And, of course, what happened on August the 8th and 9th in that time is that, in fact, Georgia had launched a very bloody assault in South Ossetia, commanded by their completely nutball president, Saakashvili, who is advised by, has many American advisors, including one permanently lodged in Tbilisi. And it was to that attack on in South Ossetia that the Russians responded. Of course, that was in the larger framework that over months and indeed years, the United States has been sponsoring and pushing Georgia, you know, urging it along the path towards NATO membership. It's been supplying its army, sending armed advisors, and so on and so forth. So obviously the Russians, already furious at these emplacements in the Czech Republic and in impending in Poland, now signed, see this as a gradual process of encirclement, an attack obviously setting up a situation where it's easier for the U.S. to exploit the oil resources in the Caspian Basin. So when they then had this very bloody assault in South Ossetia, where the South Ossetians in the majority actually are sympathetic to Russia and see Georgia as their enemy, as they do in next door in Abkhazia, they actually welcomed the Russians in. And, of course, the Russians responded very vigorously and drove out the Georgians. And then, indeed, they went into Georgia and into Stalin's old hometown of Gori. So that's the background. The press managed to avoid, in drawing that picture of plucky little Georgia, like plucky little Poland before the Second World War, they missed all this out. Or the fact that it seems to me fairly likely that McCain's advisor, Randy, what is he, Schnurman?
Something like that. I can't recall off the top of my head.
You know, who's both been on McCain's payroll and on Georgia's payroll. Until May of this year, he was on Georgia's payroll simultaneously with being on McCain, and they've both paid him enormous. Well, no, Georgia's paid him much more money than McCain. That you can see, this was a guy who was a Republican operative who was very, very, played quite a strong role in setting up the war on Iraq. That it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, I think it's quite likely that he could see that an attack, a Georgian attack, would redound greatly to the advantage of a McCain campaign, as indeed it has, because it allows McCain now to thrust himself forward as the defender in terms of the old Cold War. I mean, no presidential candidate in America ever really suffered from saying, I'm going to stand up to the Russians. It's been going on, after all, since Harry Truman in 1948 until the supposed end of the Cold War in the very early 90s. Where, of course, in the intervening 10 years, despite all guarantees issued at the time, the Americans have been prosecuting a very vigorous drive to expand their NATO membership and gradually, you know, nibble away at various areas around the old Soviet Union and next to now Russia. So McCain saw this as a moment of vast opportunity and immediately moved to exploit it. He sent Cindy off there. He himself is allegedly on the phone twice a day to Saakashvili and has seen this as something he can ride into the White House on the platform of a new Cold War. We had the old Cold War starting in the Truman era. We had the second Cold War, which began in the late 70s, sponsored by Jimmy Carter and then by Ronald Reagan. And now it looks like we're heading on our way to the third new Cold War.
our guest, Alexander Coburn. You're listening to Media Matters. Let's go to the phone lines right now. We've got a couple of callers who have been
My cockatiel is here. He's talking a lot, too.
Yes, I hear that. Yeah, he wants to get something in on this.
If any of your listeners think I'm actually secretly in Africa, I'm not. I'm in Northern California.
Okay. Let's go first to line four, Chicago. You're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Hello. Thank you for having this gentleman on. I don't know who he is. I'd like to know a little bit of his background, and I'm in complete agreement with what I've been hearing. I tuned in a couple minutes after the program started, and I'm in complete agreement with Jimmy, former President Jimmy Carter. And I don't know too much about the Russian business, but I know it seems like the United States is constantly aggravating everybody and causing trouble. And I wish they'd stop. I'm a patriot of this country, but I don't think those people in the White House are. So I'd like to know if this gentleman has written any books or anything more about him. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Alex, how do you like that? We've got a new fan for you today.
There you go. Well, I'll just say to the gentleman, anybody else who doesn't know who I am, I'm there on Counterpunch every week, and I have done a number of books. If you look me up, Alexander Coburn, The Golden Age is in Us, and the Corruptions of Empire II, and a number of others. And I've been I'm from Ireland. I've been in this country since the early 70s. Worked for the Village Voice. Now I've been writing a column for the Nation magazine for the last 20 years. And I guess you'd describe me as what a radical journalist.
That would certainly be the first two words that would come to my mind. Well, Alex,
in other words, another dirty commie.
That's right. Alex, before we go to the next caller, I want to follow up on the Georgia stuff and what this caller was suggesting. I mean, John McCain clearly has made Georgia sort of a new Cold War, as you've put it. That's in his vision. But as I've said in the question, both Joseph Biden and Barack Obama and their speeches seem to be sympathetic to that framing. What's your sense of any division between the Democrats and Republicans on an issue like this?
I mean, if you look at what Obama's original response was, it was more temperate than McCain, which is not difficult since McCain was completely out to lunch. Biden is a seasoned Cold Warrior. I mean, you know, Biden talk about change and hope. As I wrote last week in Counterpunch, anything more unchanging and hopeless than Joe Biden is hard to be imagined. I mean, basically, he's, of course, a spokesman for the corporations and banks that headquarter themselves in Delaware, which he's the senior senator. But it was actually made me laugh to hear Obama talk about trying to amend the bankruptcy laws, you know, which plague poor people. I mean, the Bankruptcy Act of 2006 was shepherded through Congress by Republicans, of course, but with the absolute connivance of Biden. You know, who is, of course, a spokesman for the banks and always has been. By the way, I should just say, since someone was inquiring about me, anyone try to look me up, remember my name is spelled C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N, Cockburn, and pronounced Coburn. Anyway, so I think they just felt they had to cover their flanks, but I think someone like Biden, they know perfectly well. You know, he's been in the Senate since, the early 70s, that you just never went broke going to the American people on standing up to the terrible Russians. Although here the grounds are even more specious than usual in this Georgian business, where Saakashvili, the Georgian president, is, apart from the fact that, you know, his to talk about Georgia's plucky little democratic Georgia ignores the fact that the last election of Saakashvili was widely charged with being completely corrupt. With the vote tallies jimmied around, that the Russians were defending their people in South Ossetia who were being killed by the Georgian bombardments. And the people of South Ossetia, you know, who now want independence and alliance with Russia, you get the incredible irony of the United States, of course, pushing for the independence of Kosovo from Serbia, and now, you know, completely bending around their positions when it comes to South Ossetia, saying no, you should be remain within the clutches of Georgia. Incredible hypocrisy.
Before
and of course, how any American can talk with a straight face when, as Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, did about this is the 21st century, people don't invade other countries. I mean, how anybody can say that without actually laughing is beyond my imagination.
Alexander Coburn, before we go back to the phone lines, let's wrap up some discussion of foreign policy issues, because one of the other trends of the last few months that have emerged in the presidential debate has been the Barack Obama and Democratic argument that the good war for the United States is in Afghanistan, not in Iraq or necessarily in Iran. And that's where the attention should be going. And what's your assessment of that argument?
I think it's absolutely ludicrous. I mean, I think originally Obama was stressing Afghanistan because he thought he needed cover for his position on withdrawal from Iraq. So he, rather than just say, let's just cut these wars out, he sort of said, okay, I'll say no to the Iraq war, but by way of compensation, just to show that I'm tough, I'll say that we have to really go after the terrorists in Afghanistan. Indeed, he had some completely mad proposal, which I think he slightly withdrew in the end, of even using nuclear weapons in the Hindu Kush or some absolutely bonkers idea. But now, of course, it's building up much more. I mean, you can argue that what they're doing there is a very traditional. Some people say it's all about control, control of a possible move northwards into the oil resources in Asia there, and that they need to maintain their presence in Afghanistan for that. But as part of the war on terror, it's obviously completely unjustifiable. I mean, it's absurd and very sinister, actually. I think the more you look at Obama, some people, like, they take his Latin American policy. We ran an intelligent piece the other day on our site by Laura Carlson saying, it requires a little bit of a leap of faith, but maybe Obama really is interested in trying to change, U.S., traditional U.S. imperial relations with Latin America. I don't know. I think it's very late in the game to be giving anybody the benefit of the doubt in that area.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Alexander Coburn, who you've been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. This is WILL AM 580. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to our phone lines now, and let's go to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Alexander Coburn.
Good afternoon. Ironies abound. I can't quite decide where to start. I think I'll leave it to Jeffrey Sinclair to keep working on you about climate disruption as we have this perhaps level five going to hit New Orleans. Would that it only hit D.C. instead. An irony that about the Georgian situation that I hasn't been remarked upon much, and perhaps I missed it in your writings, but we seem to be going after territorial integrity that was instituted by the Russian Revolution, and more specifically by Stalin, who Condi Rice apparently is supposed to hate vigorously. But Ossetia was given to Georgia in something like 21 or 22, Abkhazia in 31 when Stalin was the single dictator. It's ludicrous if it wasn't so dangerous. I mean, the selective memory hole. Comment on that, if you will. But I also, in your written counterpunch, which I haven't gotten yet, you mentioned the Russian banks, and there's a lot of talk about the bear being humiliated, and now it's showing its stuff. But there are actual grievances that go back to the Yeltsin-Clinton period of larceny at a grand scale, and I would like for you to comment on that, if you would.
Well, I think you're alluding to I wrote a story, indeed, in our newsletter, the current newsletter, as a matter of fact, about a suit conducted by the Russian Customs Service against a very, very large private bank. It's called the Bank of New York. In fact, it was in part founded by Alexander Hamilton. It's America's oldest bank and is now actually called the Bank of New York Mellon, which can join with the Mellon interests, of course, in Pittsburgh billionaires. And the rather well-documented accusation, well, it's in fact, you can read the documents, it's not hard to find the site, is that when the Soviet Union fell and Russia was open for pillage, officially open for pillage, otherwise known as installing market relations, a lot of American banks went swarming in there to do business. among them the Bank of New York, and they had people working for it who fairly rapidly set up a money-washing operation so that people inside Russia, a lot of them former communist officials, mafia, Russian mafia people, and so forth, began simply sending vast sums of money out of Russia. And they sent them to these people who worked for the Bank of New York, this couple, actually. And then the people in the Bank of New York got the money and immediately sent it on to bank accounts in the South Pacific. So it was a straight money washing. And they, in fact, the Bank of New York was then accused by the U.S. attorneys in Manhattan of this, and actually there was a cease and desist, and they were very heavily fined. But now the amount of money washed out in this particular series with the Bank of New York, the Bank of New York said it didn't notice, the officials didn't notice, was $7 billion. Well, there's a triple penalty under RICO, which is under the conspiracy laws, and the Russians are now suing the Bank of New York for $23 billion, which is actually a third of the total capital of the Bank of New York, with the trial going on in the hearings going on in a court in Moscow. Among those testifying for the Russians are some rather familiar names, including Alan Dershowitz, Professor Alan Dershowitz, and also the guy who actually, a guy called Blakey, who actually wrote the RICO laws. So the Russians have actually a fairly strong case, and that's what it's all about. I did point out the other day that the Bank of New York owns 76% of the Bank of Georgia, which gives you a fairly good idea of, you know, just how closely entwined now Georgia and the United States are, since the largest bank in Georgia is actually owned by the Bank of New York.
Alex, before we go back to the phone lines, I want to get your take on the Sarah Palin appointment or selection as John McCain's vice presidential running mate, and your take on McCain in general.
Oh, yeah. Well, on Palin, I don't know. I'm glad he selected her. It's made the race a lot of fun. You know, Biden, I mean, did you get up in the morning with a song in your heart when he nominated Biden? No, you did not. I think I feel safe in suggesting to you. You know, he's just a completely deadly, predictable choice. I think probably the Israel lobby had a lot to do with it, because they don't really trust Obama. And they think that they need someone like Biden in there. Just like they put, you know, Gore in there to... it's a funny irony, you know. I was just thinking about this. If Gore picked Lieberman, and I think part of that was actually, you know, to try and sort of allure Jewish voters. Well, if Gore had picked Bob Graham of Florida, who was one of the people put up, he probably would have won Florida, and he would have won the election. So there you are. It doesn't always pay to try and satisfy the Israel lobby. But I think that choosing Biden had a lot to do with that. And I wish, you know, that that Obama had chosen someone interesting like Webb, which I think would have been a very interesting choice. Now, on the other side, so McCain goes for Palin, which is, of course, a fairly, you know, extreme and surprising choice, as everybody's saying. I don't think it's necessarily as dumb as people are suggesting. She seems pretty smart to me and quite interesting. I mean, she actually did take on the three most powerful people in Alaska, who are Stevens, Murkowski, and Don Young, the triumvirs of Alaska, who've been running the place and stealing the place blind for decades, and in 2 years she'd finished them off. That's an incredible achievement for someone who stepped into national, statewide politics only 2 years ago. So she's obviously no Dumbo, and she obviously has got some guts to do that. She, of course, has conservative Christian beliefs, but that's, you know, there she is. She also did go to the oil companies in Alaska and get a higher levy out of them. So she actually took on the large oil companies up there. Of course, environmentally, she's kind of a bit of a nightmare. She's in, you know, favor of shooting bears from the air. She's in favor of an absolutely terrible mine that's scheduled to go in. So it's slightly odd because McCain, in some ways, has a better environmental record than Obama, who's pretty bad. I mean, Obama, if you listen to his speech carefully, on Thursday night, you know, he confirmed that he's in favor of nuclear power, he's in favor of offshore drilling, he's in favor of so-called clean coal, he's in favor of biofuels, which we all know are a really bad thing. The whole ethanol lobby is behind him. So he's a bit of a nightmare, and McCain could have probably got some points by distinguishing himself from this a little bit, but with Palin on board, it's going to be much harder for him. But let's see how she campaigns. I think she could certainly firm him up in places like North Carolina and so forth, and she seemed self-possessed and assured in her initial speech. And there's also, I think this argument about experience doesn't go very far. First of all, Americans have a sort of populist feel that put someone in new and they can run it just as well as anybody else. I always rather like that feeling, actually. So, you know, it doesn't bother me too much that he appointed her.
Do you think it's an important who wins this election, or do you think the outcome will, for the lives of people in this country and around the world, will not change appreciably regardless of who's elected?
Well, it has to be said that McCain is a pretty unstable guy. I mean, I think he is dangerous, I think. And I think, you know, even Republican colleagues in the Senate have said the guy blows his stack. He's unstable. I mean, Obama made a kind of reference to it by referring to his temperament the other night. And if immediately he's trying to cook up the new Cold War and you've got this guy who's, you know, has severe problems of temperament. He's blown off at people. He's lost his temper. He's screamed at people. We have people who we know at Counterpunch who were, you know, down there in Arizona, you know, who'd gone to lobby on the Mount Graham issue down there with McCain, and he started screaming, the veins throbbing on his head, and he completely lost control. So that is scary. There's no question about it. So so I think you'd have to say, if you want the world to be, you know, not if you're looking at the nuclear clock, you probably have to say Obama's the better bet. In terms of substantive changes at home and in overseas relations, I mentioned some people think there's a possibility that things will ease up in Latin America, but I think people consistently overestimate the power of a president, the power of someone like Obama. You know, how quickly these people get circumscribed, you know, in their room for maneuver, how quickly if they try and do something innovating, they immediately get jumped on by the press corps. And, you know, I mean, Bill Clinton was unbelievably incompetent in his first months in office. But, you know, as soon as he tried to do something, there were a couple of things he tried to do. He just got savaged and they dropped everything. I think the Clinton presidency, as anything possibly innovative, was over by mid-1993, right? So I think Obama's, assuming he makes it, which I think is very much open to question, assuming he makes it, given the, you know, the race factor, given the fact that people in the key states are probably lying a bit to the pollsters about they don't want to reveal that they're against a black person ever being in the White House. If you look at those polling numbers, well, of course, he's got a bit of a bounce because of the convention, but if you look at those numbers in, I don't know, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, it'll be a very, very close-run thing. But I'd have to say between the two of them, in terms of just the nutball factor, probably you'd have to say Obama's the better bet.
Our guest, Alex Coburn. This is Media Matters. You're listening to WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines for two callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's start with line two. Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Alexander Coburn.
Yeah, I was wondering when you was going to get to the people out here.
Well, I've done it.
You know, it seemed like the people that's on the air just seem to go on and on and on.
That's what we're here for.
I mean, I am 72 years old. I'll be 73 in January. And McCain is an unstable man. McCain, I go back a long ways about him and things with him in the SNL scandal. He has had nothing but lobbyists around him. He is corrupt. He was being paid off by Georgia. And everybody know that the White House pushed this nut over there in Georgia to challenge Russia. And Russia came back on them. I think they went a little bit too far, but they was trying to teach them a lesson and thing. And that guy is a nutcase over there, too. And another thing, as far as I'm concerned, I think he was getting paid off by this Georgia over there. I'm for people to have their freedom and things, but when you try to push somebody, some other country, and put our boys and girls into another wall, we don't need a nutcase like that. And another thing, before we go, with McCain pushing, put this Palin woman in there with all of the qualified people that he had to choose from. He think that Hillary Clinton's people is that stupid, you know? And I'm waiting to see how true the people in this country will be. Black people went and put Hillary Clinton. I voted for Hillary Clinton in the primaries, but I changed my mind as time went by. I voted for Clinton. Black folks stuck behind those people. All black folks have done is voted for a white man. Now, what's so difficult about white people voting for a black man who is very well qualified and whatever he says about his qualifications, he's an intelligent man. You hear me? And I think he's very well qualified. I just don't see how come white folks can't vote for a black man. Talk on that.
Thank you thank you very much, caller. Alex, I think that gets to the heart of the matter.
There you go. Well, that's fine what she said. Was there a question in there?
Yeah, I think there was. The whole issue of what's with white people not being, you know, black people have been voting for whites, especially white Democrats, for a long time. Why can't white Democrats vote for a black person?
Well, they've got race. I mean, you know, there are racists in the world, as I'm sure the person who just spoke said. And that's just the way they are. Let's hope they clean up their act and change their minds.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, thank you again for your patience. You're on the air with Alexander Coburn.
Hi. Nice to speak to, you know, intelligent journalists and broadcasters. And just thank you so much, Bob McChesney, for the great show you put on here. And
well, thank you.
And I have heard of Alexander Coburn, and I ordered your speech on a KPFA premium in 91.
There you go.
There you go. I have heard of you. Anyway, I just something that just drives me insane is how they're letting the opium growers in Afghanistan just produce bounties and bounties of opium with, you know, it just seems like almost an unreported story. And there was a NOW program that showed our troops actually in. If you turn the sound off, it looked like you were guarding the opium field. I mean, if you turn the sound off, you know, and then there's all this, you know, previous history of the CIA working with actual heroin traffickers. What's up with that?
Well, that's,
do you have information about that? That's my big question.
Yeah, well, actually, I and my co-editor at Counterpunch, Jeffrey Sinclair, we did a book called Whiteout, which is about drugs, the press, and the CIA. Very good book. You can actually order it through the Counterpunch website, in which we address exactly this matter. It really we got into it because of Gary Webb and the story the late Gary Webb did about.
I'll go off the air now, but thanks for mentioning Gary Webb too.
Yeah.
CIA connections with the drug traffickers.
Indeed. Well, Gary Webb, you know, the journalist,
thank you, caller,
exposed these shipments of drugs from Central America with the connivance of the CIA into the United States, and we went back right to the beginning years of the CIA after the Second World War and how they connived with the French and Italian drug smuggling gangs. They turned a blind eye to shipments into the United States. This is all very well documented, in return for the Italian and French mafias helping them wipe out communists in the post-war elections. And you can see that time after time, whether it was in Europe or whether it was in Southeast Asia, or whether it was in Iran, or whether it was in Latin America, the CIA invariably formed alliances against radical nationalist forces with criminal elements, and of course with the large drug barons. I mean, to go specifically to Afghanistan in the late 70s, when there was a leftist government in Afghanistan that tried to introduce a measure of land reform. And what happened almost immediately, of course, is that after the U.S. Came in, to attacking the Russians, and the Russians finally quit, that led to a complete restoration of the old drug baronies in Afghanistan. So when you say the U.S. troops looked on the film as though they were there guaranteeing the harvest, in the larger sense, that's absolutely true. That people have pointed out that the minute the Taliban were driven out in 2000 and what was it 2000 and
was it late one or early two?
Late one and early two. You know, the Taliban had suppressed the opium trade for a while. That the contribution Afghanistan was making to the world supply of processed of opium and processed heroin once again shot up. Till now, it's of course the largest supplier in the world. So that is what's happening, and that's always been the case. Because obviously, if you're trying to attack radical nationalist secular forces, you go for the old landowners, the old drug growers, and so forth. So it's absolutely inherent and has been to U.S. foreign policy for many, many years.
Alex, we're staying on foreign policy and international politics a little longer than I'd hoped, but there's one more question I do want to get to you, which concerns the Iraq war. Counterpunch, your website, has frequent coverage of the war, oftentimes from your brother Patrick, who's been a guest on this program. In the U.S. presidential debate, John McCain has sort of changed the discussion of the Iraq war to being largely about the surge. And there's a new meme that this war has been a success and that the United States has come very close to winning the war. What is your assessment of what's actually happening in Iraq today?
Well, I think that's, of course, all nonsense. I mean, what really happened was that the situation has changed. First of all, the civil war, you know, between the Shia asserting control and driving the Sunni out of, you know, areas of Baghdad was effectively over. So things were due to quieten down simply because the ethnic cleansing or the religious cleansing and the civil war was really over, and the Shia won. And so that obviously there was going to be a diminution in violence because, you know, the violence had achieved its objective. Although, you know, there are still very high levels of, as my brother constantly points out, you know, Baghdad remains the most dangerous city in the world. The levels of violence and death are still extremely high. Obviously, you're not finding, you know, 6,000 people dying a month because that was to do with this absolutely ferocious civil war that went on before. Now what's happened, I think, is that, you know, gradually Maliki, the Iranians, had simply said it was unacceptable that, you know, the U.S. were gradually sponsoring a recovery by the Sunni. And Iran said that's totally unacceptable. So in a sense, now both Iran and the United States are guarantors of Maliki. Iran told Muqtada to quit, basically, which he's now effectively has. You've now got Maliki feeling a lot stronger and feeling a lot more confident in the Iraqi national forces, and indeed now calling for a U.S. withdrawal by 2011. And they have felt strong enough to insist that the U.S. remove from the proposed treaty they've been mulling over for several months a whole number of conditions. So when someone like Obama says, you know, I will dictate the pace of withdrawal, in a sense, the Iraqis have, with the Iranians behind them, are having a lot of influence on what the American schedule will be. But the idea that the surge itself, you know, change the whole every counter in the Iranian on the Iraqi chessboard is absolute nonsense.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest today on Media Matters is Alexander Coburn, co-editor of Counterpunch. You can find that at counterpunch.org on the web, and you can order the print edition there. Alex Coburn also writes for The Nation magazine and has a column that's distributed to fine newspapers everywhere. Let's go now to line one. Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. Two quick comments and a question. Number one, we provoked Russia when we tried to establish NATO. We're putting in the anti-ballistic missiles in Poland and equipping Georgia's army. Number two, I don't want any of the current women to be close to the presidency. If the current crop is any indication, Mrs. Clinton said, no negotiations without preconditions, despite the fact that that has not worked in over 7 years for the Bush administration. Nancy Pelosi is a complete defeatist, get out, retreat, and then Ocandi Rice telling the Israelis, your settlements are not helpful, that is a diplomatic bunk. Those settlements are crucial to a possible settlement. Now, my question is, isn't it a fact that the Israelis did open the border crossing, but the Gaza people in Gaza continue to rocket the Israelis, so they closed it, and that's what they get for their rocketry. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alex?
Well, I don't agree with the premises or indeed the conclusions of that question. I mean, if the caller seemed to think that these settlements were an assistance to peace, I think I heard him say that, was I think everybody in the entire world, except for perhaps the government of Israel, the settlers, and your caller in Obana, and, you know, of course, the Israel all-or-nothing brigade here, they say that settlements help. They don't. I mean, they've been a leading obstruction. And gradually, these settlements, you know, all of them illegal, have encroached on what Palestinian areas, so that what might have been a little state of Palestine is now being nibbled away like Swiss cheese. Doesn't have any substance, as opposed to the Gaza siege. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous what he says. I mean, absolutely inhuman general siege of Gaza has taken place for a very long time now, with unspeakable suffering inflicted on the inhabitants. It's not the fault of the Gazans. It's the fault of the Israel and of the United States and Europe who are egging them on.
Let's go now to our last caller for Alex Coburn today, Line 4, Spring Bay. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Yes, I'm familiar with Counterpunch, and I've read your articles, and I particularly like Mike Whitney. Well, I'm going to take this a little different direction in terms of the big picture. We can argue about the Palestinians, the Israelis, the Mafia, the Orange Revolution, the Red, you know, all that. But it seems to me that energy crisis, population explosion, climate change, these big ideas we're still not getting enough information on. And I'll throw that out and let you react to it, and I'll get off, and good program once again.
Thank you very much. Alex?
Well, I mean, not enough information. I think there's... I tend to think that, I don't know, information in our conversation or information available in the press in general. I'm not quite sure where you're...
I assume the latter.
In available in general.
Yeah, the press and in the media for the average person who just wants to find out what's going on in the world.
Although I have to say, I think most people, you can find out, if you confine yourself to the media, that's a voluntary, these days, that's a voluntary decision on your part, since everybody really is online these days. At least I think they are. Whenever I give a meeting and I say, how many people are online, doesn't matter what income groups you're talking to, what age groups you're talking to. The last time I was in a meeting, I asked, you know, how many people are online, and I think everybody in the room, except for maybe one person, I think it was everyone, put their hand up. So, the information is there on the net. You can find it, and it's not too hard to get. It's not like when I was in New York in the 1970s and writing about the issues of Israel and Palestine, you know, and you didn't have fax machines, you didn't have the internet, you had to go run up the road to Times Square and go to the out-of-town bookstore and try and buy a French newspaper and come back and translate it, and so on and so forth. It was tough. Nowadays, you can read Haaretz. Some of the best reporting from Israel and the occupied territories is in, you know, Hebrew language Haaretz, which now has an English language edition. You know, in the old days, Israel Shahak, a wonderful guy who's dead now, used to send translations of the Hebrew language press, which he used to run off on a gestetner. I don't know how many of your audience these days even know what a gestetner is, you know, to 100 or so people. And that's the way you'd find out. Now you can go to any newspaper on the planet, practically, or any websites, and, you know, look up and Counterpunch and find 100 different things. So even on climate change, where I have rather different views, if you go to Counterpunch and think that there is, world's getting warmer, but that human agency has got nothing to do with it, you can even look up my views on this matter on Counterpunch.
You know, Alex, we only have a few minutes left, and there is another caller I'd like to get to. We did get someone who emailed in precisely on that point. You have taken the position, correct me if I characterize it inaccurately, that while global warming and climate change exist, the evidence that it has related to human activity is not sufficient for you, and you've been criticized by this. This summer, There was an article in Monthly Review by John Farley specifically going, addressing your criticism and challenging it and questioning it. Did you see Farley's article?
I didn't actually. First I've heard of it. But by and large, I think, you know, now the temperature, the world's been getting slightly cooler in the last 2 or 3 years. A lot of the more lurid predictions have gone out the window. The general, I mean, again, you can look up the article, but the argument that humanly produced greenhouse gases have actually altered global mean temperatures has not been substantiated. I don't know what Farley says, but a lot of the empirical data is pretty clear about this. And of course now, you know, it's a bit embarrassing for them. You had the coldest winter on the planet last year for many years. It looks like another very cold one is coming up. A lot of the indicators which they were, and there's been a bit less noise from people like Hansen this year, I've noticed. And a lot of people are complaining, yeah, the summer was kind of cool. And so I do think the world has been getting warmer. If you believe the Russians, that the sunspot situation has changed slightly. So starting with 2011 and 12, you'll have a global cooling period. In general, I mean, there have been warmings and coolings of the planet for billions of years, long before Henry Ford wheeled the first automobile out of the shed. A lot of the claims, like the famous hockey stick calculation about, you know, medieval warming period and all the rest of it, are all completely bogus and nonsense. There's very few topics on which there's been more nonsense spouted than the global warming issue.
So does this mean we really don't have to do anything, worry about it? It's pretty much not a big
deal. Well, the world can get warmer. I mean, one thing that's happening, actually, the world is, because it's getting warmer and there is more CO2, mostly from the oceans, the planet's getting a little greener. You can comfort yourself with that. You know, conditions are changing. I mean, weather is weather. You know, you can get stressed. I live in a big earthquake zone. We had a 7.1 here in 1994. You can have, again, there's a lot of debate as to whether the hurricane, one of your callers mentioned the hurricane cycle in connection with global warming. A lot of the hurricane experts say it's got absolutely nothing to do with it. But, of course, you know, the earth is stressed by weather change all the time. What I think is new is the sort of Promethean idea that humans can really influence the weather. And I think there is, which is a lot, we can fix every problem. I keep getting things in email, how we can solve climate change. It's like, I don't know, how can we solve the problem of gravity and make it a little bit less so we can fly higher? I mean, it's all ridiculous. You're dealing with that natural forces on which, as someone remarked, you know, human intervention in these natural forces and forces at work in the planet, from the electromagnetic field through to, you know, wind intensities and the like, you know, the human contribution is, like someone put it to me, like a fart in a hurricane, near zero. So people have this Promethean idea that they can change things. I mean, these lunatics, I'm sure they're all very well-meaning, you know, thinking if you close down Heathrow, you're going to reverse global warming. I never heard such stupid stuff in my life.
Well, Alex Coburn, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio.
That's it. You're out of there, McChesney.
I'm out of here.
Enough of you.
Enough of me for 167 hours. I'll be back in a week with Mark Crispin Miller. Until then, listeners, thank you very much. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with Counterpunch.
Thanks a lot. Everyone, to subscribe or just go look at the website.
That's right. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for arranging today's show, for all his great work, and Dave Heckman for working the board. See you all next week. And Alex, take care.
Okie dokie.